legs. The cameras were nestled all over the place, between the plates. There must have been 100 machine eyes watching me as I tore a hole in its armor. 3 times I slashed. I didn't get a 4th try. Plates flew off, clattering and clanging to the ground. A good-sized hole had opened up, but I didn't know if it would be enough. That was as far as I got before I was unceremoniously dumped on the dirt. A great flap from the outer rim rose up. The whole machine shivered forward. Then everything went dark. I was underneath it, being crushed down. The underside of the machine reminded me of a roly-poly from my grandma's backyard. There were hundreds of gray metallic feet and churning legs. They clacked and sparked on my dragon's armor. The experience left me with a panicky feeling. I knew this was how Carlos had died. As my eyes adjusted to the gloom, I could see tools hanging down from the insides of the machine. Tools mounted on arms that moved independently. I could tell already that when these steel pipes, spikes, and blades got through my dragon's hull to the soft, meaty center, it wasn't going to be a happy moment for old James McGill. "Squad!" I shouted on the comm channel. "Can you hear me? I'm inside the machine, underneath it. If I use my launchers, I'll blast myself apart."
"Hang on, Vet," Sargon said. "We're mounting a general attack."
"Go for the hole that I cut in the thing's hull," I said. "Try firing grenades in there."
"We might blast you if we do that, Vet."
Thinking about it for less than a second, I made a hard decision. I was going to have to get lucky to live this time. The luck might as well come right now. "I know," I told Sargon. "But I'll be toast anyway in less than a minute. Go for it." I waited, cringing, while the machine tried to eat me. Hardened steel can take quite a beating, but right now I was wishing I'd opted for shielding and heavy weaponry rather than faster legs on my dragon's loadout. A white flash boomed, overloading my optic nerves for a second. I was glad my ears were well covered because the noise was deafening under the enclosed surface of the machine's outer hull. I guessed one of my squad had gotten a grenade inside the machine. More explosions soon followed. It sounded like a rain of boulders on top of a metal roof. Finally, the machine gave up on eating me. It peeled itself off my dragon and shuffled away. A dozen primitive legs thumped and clattered all over me, and I was out in the open again. Kiwi's dragon helped mine to get up, but it wasn't any use. My mount couldn't walk. "I've got a bad leg actuator," I said, going through a quick diagnostics check. "The left one won't take any weight."
"Get out of the cockpit," she said. "The rest of the squad is chasing the machine, but it might turn on them at any moment."
"What about Carlos?"
"He's dead. I checked."
"What the hell am I going to do on foot?" I asked.
"Climb on my back. Watch for the heat fins. They get really hot when I run."
I knew all about that. The heat generated by a dragon in combat was excessive, and they had fins rising up out of the back to help relieve it. Ejecting myself from my mount, I climbed up onto Kiwi's dragon and perched there like a man riding an overgrown ostrich. "Sargon," I called over the squad channel. "Come back! We're getting out of here!" My squad didn't need any more encouragement. They returned a few minutes later, and we all ran together. We didn't stop until we were far from the machines. I reported in, and Leeson was pissed. "You left 2 good dragons in the field for some machines to chew on. What do you expect to ride around on tomorrow, veteran?" "I know we have a few extras back at the lifter, sir." "That's negatory, McGill," he shouted. "Your flesh is nothing. That dragon is worth 10 of you. Halt and wait. I'm coming to your position with Harris and another platoon. We're getting your machine back. Carlos's too." I didn't think I could argue him out of it, so I didn't even try. I figured it was pointless, and I also kind of wanted some company in my neck of the woods. About 2 minutes later, the whole unit showed up. We advanced at a run toward the last position where we'd make contact with the machines. When we got there, we found the dragons. But we found something else, too. A few hundred meters away were at least a dozen of the large machines. The machines were piled up in a mound. At first, it looked like one massive mountain of trembling metal.
"McGill," Graves said, "you didn't describe these machines accurately. That mass looks to be 100 meters high."
"No, sir," I said. "I don't think that's one machine. That's about a dozen of them, all piled up."
"What the hell are they doing?"
"Well, sir, I'd be guessing, but I'd say they're eating the one we damaged earlier."
"Nasty," Graves said thoughtfully. "They're cannibalizing the weak. They look like beetles gnawing on a bone."
"We don't want to be here when they finish their meal, sir. They have quite an appetite."
"Roger that," Graves said. "Get 3 dragons on each of our broken-down vehicles. Drag them up behind you on tow cables. We're bugging out of here right now."
We beat a hasty retreat, and I'd never been happier to run away in my life. Chapter 17. We were putting together an after-action report about an hour later when an unexpected guest showed up and burst in on our unit meeting. Graves, Keevy, Leeson, and I were all talking over the battle in our command tent when Primus Winslade himself swept in and sat at the end of the table. He sniffed the air as if it smelled bad, which it did.
"Primus," Graves said, "I'm so glad you could join us on the front lines."
Winslade wrinkled his nose.
"There's a special scent in the air, Graves," he said. "It's the smell of failure. I'd know it anywhere. Why is your advanced scouting team bogged down out here? You've had a full day to cross the river, and yet here you sit in your encampment."
"The river is trapped, sir," Graves said. "We've encountered underwater systems, specifically built to cripple machines. They're all over the local waterways. They're crude but effective. As far as we can tell, the machines feed on each other, and we've been trying to—"
"Let's stop the nonsense," Winslade interrupted. "I mean the part about trying to do things. I need action, Graves. I was told you were a man who could provide it. That's why I put you in charge of this advance force. The Solstice troops we're trying to rescue might all be dead by now due to your indolence."
Graves rarely became openly angry, but I could tell Winslade was pushing his buttons like a pro.
"Is that right?"
Graves asked.
"Well, sir, can you enlighten me on how things are going with the rest of the cohort? Are the majority of your units still sitting in your camp under the lifter?"
Winslade gave him an unpleasant smile.
"No, not any longer. We're all here. Just outside, in fact."
Graves looked surprised.
"When did your orders change?"
Winslade threw his hands into the air and twisted his mouth.
"Imperator Turov arrived at the site several hours ago. The location has been deemed relatively safe, so Minotaur disgorged all of Legion Varus at my base camp."
Graves nodded.
"So let me see if I understand the situation. As soon as the Imperator landed, she realized your cohort was sitting around, and she kicked you out to the front."
Winslade was displeased. He gave Graves a hard stare for a moment before speaking.
"Tactless, as always. I see now why you've been stuck with the rank of centurion for half a century."
Graves' face was stone.
"What are your orders, sir?"
"Turov has ordered all of us, the entire auxiliary cohort, to cross the river today. We're to advance to the last known position of the missing troops. I intend to follow that order immediately. Everyone pack up and move out."
That was it. There wasn't much of a plan or any argument for that matter. Turov's orders were often like that, and I wasn't surprised Winslade operated in the same fashion. We stood up as a group and headed to the dragons. Before we saddled up and rode out, I was issued a fresh dragon by the cohort quartermaster. Spare machines had been brought in with a lot of other critical supplies on the backs of our drones. The drones, or pigs as we called them, were like fast-marching mechanical oxen. They didn't move as quickly as the dragons, but they never got tired, and each could carry several tons of weight over any kind of terrain. As we gathered our equipment, I pressed Graves to let me choose a better loadout. I wanted heavy weaponry.
Agreed, he said. Speed might help when escaping those machines, but you can't win a fight by running from everything.
Grateful, I ordered my troopers to mount heavy guns on their dragons. We went without shielding, as this new enemy didn't seem to be keen on shooting projectiles at us. Within an hour, I found myself sitting in a dragon with a single cannon mounted on the spine, heavy generators, and extra cells. This setup wasn't as fast, but it was a lot more dangerous, and it could operate for an extended period of time. When we finally reached the river, I don't think any of us were looking forward to the crossing. Behind us was a long train of drones and dragons. The group slowly lined up along the shore. Most of the cavalry wore heavy kits now. Spinal cannons were everywhere. The quartermaster had complained he was out of backup units if we got any of these weapons damaged.
Leeson, McGill, Graves called to us.
Right here, sir, Leeson reported.
In his infinite wisdom, Graves began, Winslade has seen fit to have our unit be the first to ford this river.
I nodded to myself in my cockpit. Graves had kind of flipped off the new Primus when the man had crashed our little meeting. I could have told Graves how that was going to turn out. Winslade had been a vindictive little cuss when he was powerless. Now that he wore the insignia of a Primus, well, it was time for payback. I volunteer, sir, I said.
Excellent, but you'll need backup. Harris, I know you're listening. I need an experienced man behind McGill.
On my way, sir.
About 90 seconds later, I found myself marching into the silvery liquid.
You just had to do it, didn't you, McGill?
Harris complained in my headset.
Itching to die on yet another new planet. That's you in a nutshell.
That's me, vet.
All right, enough bitching, Leeson said. McGill, spread out your squad and cross at a walk. Harris, follow with your machines right behind them. Your job is to pull McGill's squad mates out of traps.
Try to walk due west, everyone. If any of the dragons gets across without a problem, we'll mark the path and everyone will follow. Go. We had our orders. I was the first man into the river. I didn't feel fear, not really. If the river didn't get too deep...
Vet! Shouted Gorman. I'm down, damn it!
We hadn't gone 20 steps. The other side was still an unknown. For all I knew, we had 5 kilometers to go. All halt, I ordered. Can one of your men get Gorman out, Harris?
We're on it.
There was a brief delay before they had Gorman up and operating again. We'd learned by this time to cut off the trap and discard it. We kept going. There was a trap encountered at intervals of about every 10 steps. I could tell this was going to be a long day. Watching my HUD, I began to frown. I was noticing a pattern.
Leeson, sir?
What is it, McGill?
I was mildly surprised to realize he was in the river with us. He was in the rear, to be sure, but he was only 10 meters behind my dragon.
Sir, did you notice the last 4 traps? They started with Gorman, then Keevy, then...
Get to the damn point, McGill. Winslade is already crawling up my butt on officer's chat.
Roger that. Sorry, sir, but I think this might help.
Keep talking and keep walking. You've got 30 seconds.
There's a pattern, sir. The dragons that have hit a trap so far are finding them in a diagonal pattern. The first man hit was Gorman, the next one hit the man next to him, then...
I get it,
Leeson said suddenly.
I see it on my HUD.
By damn, you're not as dumb as a bag of hammers after all.
Thank you, sir. Leeson barked out orders, telling people to regroup and move at a 45-degree angle to cross the river. We marched like that for a full minute, without running into anything.
We can predict this, Leeson said excitedly, and we'll get through it.
But you have to tell me, McGill, what kind of trapper fills an entire riverbed with traps using a perfectly even pattern?
A robot trapper, sir. They're nothing if not methodical.
Another thing makes sense to me now, Leeson said in an uncharacteristically thoughtful tone. This riverbed is dead level. Right here, where the river has a natural shallow area, someone lowered it. They flattened this region of the riverbed out to make it more attractive to anyone trying to cross.
Good thinking, sir, I said, and I meant it. I think you're onto something there. all part of an ancient system of capture and... That was as far as I got before something strange happened. A surge of liquid methane came downriver and rolled into us. It didn't submerge our dragons, but it did rush over our knees in a wave that was at least a meter higher than normal.
"What the hell?" Leeson squawked. "Where did that wave come from? What?"
He got his answer in a physical form before I could say anything. A vast machine rolled up out of the mist. It came down the river behind the wave it had created. I knew right off we were trapped. We could run back to the shore behind us, but if we continued on a diagonal course, we'd have to rush right into the machine that was bearing down on us.
"You asked what made the minefield, sir," I said. "I think there's your answer."
"Put a hole in it," Leeson shouted. "Unlimber those spine cannons. I want a volley on my mark. Target the center of the mass. One, two, mark!"
We all fired. There was a roar and a brilliant barrage of streaking lights. Smoke trails hung in the air behind our projectiles for a frozen moment before the impacts began to rain down. The looming machine must have thought it had caught dinner and was going to feast on our metal carcasses, but it got the surprise of its life, which promptly ended. The shells hammered through the plating and crashed into the guts of the machine, where they exploded. The machine shivered and deflated like a vast balloon that had been punctured. The platoon shouted and roared in the victory. I had to admit, I felt a surge of relief as well. But I had to ask myself, what would be the repercussions of these clashes with the natives? Could we really expect them to be tolerant of invaders? A part of me, too, wondered if this machine was the mama machine for the playful tykes I had met and tried to communicate with at the nearby village. Would they go hungry now, without a parent to fend for them? It was all very confusing, and I wasn't sure how I should feel about it. Chapter 18. After the incident in the middle of the river, we had no more trouble with the crossing. We'd figured out the pattern of traps and defeated the trapper. There were no further dangers to overcome. An hour later, the full cohort assembled on the far side of the river. It had only been about a kilometer wide in the end, but it had seemed endless. When you can't see the far side of something and danger is stalking you, time dilates, and a march becomes a slog. When we set off again, Winslade was lashing at our backsides and making cohort-wide rants.
"That took far too long," he said into my earpiece. "It will be dark in only about 4 hours. I know every legionnaire will want to quit by then, but it's not going to happen. We'll press on until we reach Point Charlie on your maps."
I looked it up. I knew I shouldn't have, but I felt the urge. When I found the next waypoint on our journey to the last known contact with the lost troops, I grimaced. There was no way we'd make it until midnight local time, even if we didn't run into another major obstacle. Part of me understood why the officers were frustrated. We were supposed to be the cavalry, but we couldn't move like cavalry. We were in unknown territory, swamped and mist, rough ground, and danger. If they'd ordered us to charge into the unknown blindly, sure, we could probably make the run within the span of a few hours. But the officers had another contradictory requirement, that we not lose their precious dragons. "Quick gains on any battlefield often require risk," I said, quoting a military strategy book I'd read to prepare for my new status as a veteran.
"What's that crap?" Harris demanded.
I'd forgotten he was still listening in on my squad chat.
"You keep a lid on that, McGill. Someone might hear you."
"Someone already has,"
Graves said. I flinched. I told myself I'd get used to the idea that I wasn't one more grunt mumbling to myself on proximity chat anymore. As a veteran, I had access to a lot of new levels of communication, and I'd just done the equivalent of a reply-all to the entire unit.
"For the record, I agree with McGill,"
Graves said.
"We should just get this over with and quit walking like frightened infantry in expensive machines. With a vanguard of fast-moving troops, we can risk a unit and follow with a large column afterward. If the first group hits a major obstacle, well, we can decide how to handle it situationally.
That way you risk losing a single unit, but the entire force moves at triple the pace. Risk equals gain, as McGill said. My private chat line was blinking. It was Harris. I had no doubt he was calling to give me a reaming. He hadn't talked to me this much since I'd had my chat with Della in his squad's tent. Harris's distance had been just fine with me. Now, as I eyed the contact light, I wondered if I should open the channel or not. I decided to ignore it. Another call came in from Graves. I took that one.
"McGill,"
Graves said,
"I've come to a decision. I'm kicking your suggestion up to Winslade. Hold on."
A long, groaning sound came out of my mouth. I finally opened the private talk line with Harris, who was still waiting.
"I don't believe it," he said. "See? You see that? Are you even listening to Graves?"
"Yes, he just contacted me."
"That's what you get, but we all have to suffer. You see how this turns out, McGill? If you live again some day after this disaster is over and done, try to learn to keep your big mouth shut, okay? That is, if you aren't permed along with the rest of us."
He cut the channel before I could reply. It was just as well. I was all out of snappy comebacks anyway. I had a feeling he might be right. The next few minutes were uncomfortable. Finally, the new orders came down.
"Good news, Third Unit,"
Graves announced. What got me was that the Centurion sounded honest to God happy.
"We're moving out, top speed,"
he continued.
"My unit has been awarded the honor of forging the way. Leeson, take point."
That was it. Harris's worst fears had been realized. "You heard the man," I shouted. "Saddle up, this will be a full-speed run. We're going to get this over with before darkness falls. With any luck, we'll be sipping auto-heated stew in a tent within 4 hours.
We began to run.
For the first hour, things went relatively smoothly. The land was flat and empty. There were boulders now and then, but no one wrecked their dragon. But then our luck changed. We ran into a broken region of badlands. There were gullies, pits, and wind-carved rocks everywhere. By this time, everyone in the cohort had a channel tuned to the low-frequency bands the machines used for communication. Our computers filtered out all but the strongest, close-range contacts. If the big machines came near, we would be warned by their radioed whale songs. There weren't any problems until we reached the midpoint of the Badlands. In a particularly deep gully, we met up with a series of warbling contacts. A lot of them. "Centurion Graves, we've got company dead ahead," I reported in.
"Roger that, I can see the readouts. Advance your platoon, Leeson. Give me an accurate count on the wildlife. Then I'll phone this into Winslade to see what he wants to do. Remember to use only low-powered radio to talk, and hold your ground until told to do otherwise. Don't bring an avalanche of enemy machines back home to the main column."
Leeson ordered Harris to swing right and me to swing left. I had to wonder if Graves still hated me, or if his habit of picking Leeson, Harris, and I to do his most hazardous missions was some kind of compliment. I figured it was probably a mixture of both, and possibly it had just become reflexive for him. Whatever the case, I found myself at the very front of the line yet again as we trotted our dragons between looming boulders, bubbling streams of methane, and metallic-looking rocks with sharp edges. We finally broke through to a region close enough and wide enough to see what we were facing. I was confused at first. The machines were all in one tight area. "Looks like that mound of machines we found eating their wounded brother back on the lake shore," I said.
"Sure does,"
Sargon said, coming close. We were peering down into a churning pit of machines. There were about 20 of them, and they were roaming around and appeared to be feeding. I knew the look by this time. The machines would kind of hunker down and shiver a little when they found something good to eat.
"Hey," Sargon said, "look over there. Is that what I think it is?"
I followed his dragon's outstretched gripper. Peering in the gloomy light, I nodded at last. "Yeah, I think so. That's a dead trooper." We'd found the Solstice infantry, or what was left of them. Looking back down into the open pit area, I began to figure out what I was seeing. We're looking at the remains of the proud Legion Solstice, I said grimly. They must have made a last stand here in the Badlands. Trapped in this little box canyon, they fought and lost. These machines are feeding on the armored suits of their dead.
Makes me sick, Sargon said. Permission to destroy these scavengers, Vet?
Permission denied, for now. It's not my call. Sargon looked at me. I could see his face lit up inside his faceplate by his instrumentation. He was enraged, and I didn't blame him.
Come on, McGill, he said. Since when did you play anything by the book? Let's charge down there and smoke those machines. If we move fast, it'll be over before anyone knows what's going on. If the whole cohort shows up in the middle of the action, they'll back us up without a question.
You could be right, I said, but I'm playing this one straight. Sorry, Sargon. I have the feeling we'll get the chance to blast plenty of machines apart before this campaign is over, if it makes you feel any better. Sargon shook his head and glowered back down the slope at the gorging machines.
If you're bucking for adjunct already, forget it. They don't often move an enlisted man up into the officer's ranks.
I knew he was emotional, and I didn't blame him. It looked like we'd found a wiped legion. I couldn't recall the last time Earth had lost one of the reputable legions like Solstice. Sure, we could revive them all if we got their data. That wasn't the point. It was a defeat. A humiliation. 2,000 years ago, in Roman times, I said, the worst defeat ever suffered was in the forests of Germany. They lost 3 full legions on that doomed campaign. I feel now as if I can fathom some of the dismay the Romans must have felt at that loss. Sargon's mood shifted.
Ha! Good one, McGill. Vicious, but funny.
Huh?
You know they named our legion Varus after the commander of those 3 legions Rome lost in Germany, right?
Yeah.
Well, the name was a joke, because we were meant to die over and over again, he said bitterly. But now here we are, looking down at the remains of the Golden Legion. Solstice died here, not us. The joke is on them this time, sorry bastards. Maybe their name will mean loser someday, too.
Sargon wheeled around and left. I followed him. I made my report, and various officers came up to survey the mess. All the while, I was thinking about Sargon's bitter words. I knew we'd been named after Publius Quinctilius Varus, the unluckiest leader in the history of the Roman Empire, and I'd heard that we'd been given the name as some kind of a joke. But I didn't find it funny. It made me want to drag the hog generals out of their offices back home on Earth and put them into light troop uniforms out here on the front line. We'd see who was laughing then. Some of Sargon's dark mood was sinking into my mind.
Chapter 19. Quietly, on a private channel, I asked Natasha to send out a certain radio signal that we'd isolated and recorded earlier. She'd theorized it was sort of a dinner bell, a call from one machine to all those in the area that rich metals were available at a given location. It turned out that Natasha's theories were correct. I don't think Leeson, Graves, or Winslade himself ever quite figured out how our first major battle with the native machine life started. Oh, sure, the officers might have had their private suspicions, but they couldn't be sure. Natasha, always faithful in these situations and equally accountable for the aftermath in any case, kept her pretty mouth shut. There were about 30 of the big machines in the mountains around us when we transmitted the signal. We'd only spotted about half that number, but the rest came running when we sounded the dinner bell.
James,
Natasha called on our private channel as the machines rushed up rough mountainous walls, quivering and clattering for a grip on the terrain.
I'm getting a response to my message.
You sure are, I said. The machines are rolling in from all over.
No, I don't mean that. Someone must be alive down there, underneath all the wreckage. They heard our signal and blipped back something in return.
Really? Excellent.
You need to have a little more faith in me, girl.
I sent the damned message, didn't I? If we live, you owe me a drink.
Done. That was all the time we had for chit-chat. What was lucky for us was the lack of coordination in the machine attack. They acted more like a swarm of starving sharks than an army. Rather than timing the assault so they all reached us at once, they came in successive waves. "On my target!" I roared, hearing Harris echoing the same command. I lit up the nearest machine with a laser marker built into my dragon. "Right flank, center of mass, fire!" We took the first 7 or 8 down without mishap. But then they were rolling over the ridges above us and falling on us. Some had circled around, hitting our flanks. Other combat units had formed on hillocks farther to the rear, but they didn't have the same clear field of fire that I did. A few maniples were overrun and ground down by the sheer weight of the enemy machines. Out of Graves' unit, 6 dragons were down and being consumed. 12 more were in too close to safely use their big guns. 4 blades were extended, and the grim work of dismantling the enemy piece by piece began. What saved us in the end, I think, was the greed of the enemy machines. Rather than pressing the attack, those in the rear fell upon their mortally wounded comrades. The smoking wrecks of machines we'd blasted were sent sliding back down into the valley, where they flipped over and exposed their damaged guts. This was simply too tempting to the last waves of machines. They pounced upon the fallen and feasted. After 5 minutes, it was all over. The enemy machines had all been destroyed, had fallen back, or were busy cannibalizing their own. Graves approached me, and we gazed down upon a scene of destruction.
"We won that one," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"I didn't even see you fire the first shot to kick things off. How'd you manage it?"
"Manage what, Centurion?" I asked. Graves shook his head disgustedly. "By the way, sir," I said, "we detected a new message coming from under this pile of broken metal. We have confirmed it was transmitted by Legion Solstice survivors. They're down there, Centurion. Permission to attempt a rescue?"
"Since when did you ask my permission to do anything, McGill?"
"There's always a first time, sir."
Graves looked over the scene. "The remaining machines are broken or busy. Funny how they're ignoring us again."
"They're driven by hunger more than anything else. It's my theory that the smaller ones might actually be more intelligent. They don't have as much mass to keep fed, so they can devote more processing time to higher pursuits."
"I hate theories," Graves said, "especially those hatched by non-coms."
He eyed my squad.
"You've only lost 1 squad member, right? Harris lost 4. You know what that means, McGill?"
"That I'm going down there to check for survivors personally, sir?"
"Exactly."
"Can I take Natasha with me? We might need a good tech."
"All right. But don't get her killed this time."
As Natasha hadn't qualified to pilot a dragon, she was riding on the back of a drone. We rode our mounts down the steep, rocky slopes to the bottom and quickly reached the coordinates Natasha provided. At first, I didn't see anything special about this spot. Then we found an entrance shrouded by a polymer shell. I rapped on the shell. There was no response. Natasha ran her drone close to my mount. She was trying to look everywhere at once. There were still at least 10 of the big machines moving around, eating the guts out of their friends.
"Just blow a hole in it," she said. "They might be too weak to respond."
"If I do that, I might kill some of them. This atmosphere is mildly toxic, and this might be their only pressurized refuge."
"Well, do something fast. Our refined metal is the most delicious thing in this region. To the machines, we're like walking chocolate bars."
Chuckling, I balled my fist and tapped an unmistakable pattern on the dome.
Tap, 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 tap.
"What's that?"
Natasha asked.
"Morse?"
"Nah, it's what my grandpa used to call shaving a haircut 2 bits.
I repeated the sequence several times, and at last, the polymer dome rolled open. Inside were worried-looking troopers with guns lifted toward our faces. The woman in the lead was the Centurion of a light unit. She had a breastplate and rifle, but no full armor.
Fortunately, her vac suit appeared to be in good condition, if a little dirty.
"Legion Varus," I said. The Centurion waved us into her den.
"Come on in, Varus," she said. "Move fast."
We rushed inside, and when the last dragon tail was tucked underground, the small dome rolled shut again.
"Don't use radio,"
the Centurion urged me.
"Don't worry, we already tried that."
"I'm surprised you survived."
We demonstrated our spinal cannons. She looked them over appreciatively.
"We don't have much in the way of heavy weaponry. A few specialists with belchers that still operate, that's it. Snap rifles don't even get their attention."
I nodded, thinking it over. Light troops would be hard-pressed to damage this enemy. The machines were just too big and too tough.
"My apologies for taking so long to get here, sir," I told the Centurion.
She looked at me for a second.
"We didn't honestly think anyone would come. I'm Centurion Belter."
"Veteran McGill." I introduced my specialists, Natasha and Sargon. We checked on the status of the surviving group. It was pretty good, all things considered. They had supplies and weapons. The injured had already died out, which made things simpler.
"Do you have a confirmation list?" Natasha asked.
Grim-faced, Centurion Belter touched her tapper to Natasha's.
"That's it. We've lost a lot more, however, I'm sure of it."
"How many people do you have hiding down here?" I asked.
"There are a few other groups like this one, although I would say there's more than a full cohort. Fortunately, the caverns are huge. We think smaller machines burrowed these tunnels years back."
I whistled. Somewhere between 80% and 90% casualties. Solstice hadn't been wiped, but it had been a damned close thing.
"We've been trying to tunnel our way out," Belter explained. "That's been the survival plan all along. The trouble is, the ground is full of metals and hard to dig through. We managed to connect tunnels with some of the other survivors in these caverns, but that's all we could do."
I thought about the surrounding cliffs of metallic ore. There wasn't much chance the Legionnaires could dig through the walls of the valley to safety. It was too far, and the earth was too dense.
"We killed most of the machines," I said. "I suggest you get your people together and follow us out. Our dragons can kill these machines with focused fire."
She shook her head.
"It's too late for that tonight," she said.
"Nightfall
is coming soon. That's when most of them show up."
Staring at her for a few seconds, I blinked, then narrowed my eyes. "Are you saying the 30-odd machines we encountered isn't all of them?" Centurion Belter laughed.
30 machines? No, that's like low tide around here. Tonight, there will be 300. Maybe more after the word gets out that there are freshly dead machine carcasses to feed on. You see, we've managed to make small breakout attacks before, but it's always caused more machines to show up.
Maybe we should get out of here right now.
She checked the tapper. Too late for that. In fact, you'd better warn the rest of your unit to come down here to hide. They'll be all around us in these spikes, crawling in to feed at this spot. It's like a watering hole for them, high-grade ore walls and all. That's why we've been trapped here, not daring to leave.
Without jawing any more about it, I retreated to the surface. Sure enough, I could see fresh machines coming in over the lips of the valley walls. Racing my dragon up to where Graves waited, I informed him personally.
"We've got to tell Winslade about this, sir," I said.
"What the hell have you gotten us into now, McGill?"
"I didn't make these crazy machines, Centurion."
"No. But you helped ring the dinner bell. Yes, I heard about that. Never mind from who."
He sighed and tried to think.
"All right,"
he said after a moment.
"I'm sending a courier now. Stand by."
In the end, Winslade arrived to see the enemy massing all around us. There were 20 machines roaming the valley, gorging themselves on refined metals. I could tell from the look in his eye that he was worried. He was a hog, not a true fighting man. Death wasn't a normal part of existence to his desk-flying kind.
"How many did Centurion Belter say were coming?"
he asked me.
"Hundreds, sir."
"We can't rescue the Solstice troopers," he said decisively.
We don't have time, and we can't outrun these machines if we're babysitting troops.
Your orders, Primus?
Graves asked. Get ready to pull out, Winslade replied.
We did as he ordered, but we didn't make it. The machines had been gathering slowly and steadily, but as darkness fell over the Badlands, they came on in a surge. They were all around us in the gullies and slithering over the hills, moving in from every direction toward our location. They were coming home to sleep or feed or mate or whatever. It didn't really matter. We were surrounded. In the end, we had to race down into the valley and stash ourselves in the caverns. The machines gave chase, but after we blasted a few and closed the polymer domes, they gave up. To them, plastic was a strange, possibly nasty-tasting material. They avoided it, and we were left in peace. Except that we were trapped underground, along with the survivors of Legion Solstice. Chapter 20 Winslade chanced a powerful transmission up into space the next morning when most of the machines had retreated. We hooked up a transceiver just outside of a tunnel mouth and blasted a high-powered compressed message up into space. The message reported our situation to Turov, who had left the surface and returned to her ships. On the planet, a fair-sized group of officers and non-coms had gathered in one of the central chambers. Overhead, the roof of the place glittered with nodules of ore and embedded crystals. We hadn't really gathered for any formal purpose. Leaders tended to clump up together to plan and talk. We hadn't known what else to do. For the most part, we were waiting on the word from above. Winslade was out of his depth, I think. He hadn't put forward any comprehensible plans of his own other than to guard the entrances and wait out the night. Winslade and Turov conversed privately. He was the only one who could hear what she said. When Winslade closed the comm channel, his face was even whiter than usual.
"They're going to use the broadsides," he told us with a flickering smile. "They're going to smash these machines all at once."
I knew right off why he was sweating. A murmur swept the room. Overhead, the ceiling sent spills of dust down into our faces. The machines, stirred up by his transmission, were rioting, tearing at the ground. I hoped they couldn't get through, or at least that they would get bored and give up before they managed to dig deeply enough. There were, by reported count, more than 100 of them hanging around tonight. More arrived every hour.
"The big guns?" asked Graves. "Fusion-powered shells landing right here on top of us?"
"That's exactly what I mean," Winslade said.
"Primus?" I said, speaking up in the stunned silence that followed Winslade's announcement.
"What is it, McGill?"
Winslade asked with a resigned voice. He was tapping at his tablet. "Sir, such a move might well kill everyone in this room." Winslade's eyeballs slid sideways from his tablet to look at me.
"That is supposition, veteran. This is an officers' meeting, and I would appreciate it if—"
"Sir?" I asked, interrupting him again. I was going for broke, but hell, I figured we were all about to die anyway. "Can you and I have a private word, sir? I might be able to help." Winslade eyed me quietly. I stared back. He had to know what I was thinking. I had a special connection with Turov. He knew that. Everyone did.
"Dismissed,"
he said, waving us away. I hung around as the officers filtered out. Graves passed me and gave me a flat frown. He shook his head slightly, discouragingly. In return, I gave him a smile and a bright nod. Sighing, he left. Winslade's eyeballs slid to me again when the last man had vacated the chamber.
"I meant you too, veteran," he said.
"Sorry, Primus, I misunderstood. But can I say one thing?"
"If you must."
"Those broadsides. Have you seen them fire on a planet before, sir?" I asked. "I was in Minotaur's Tactical Fire Control Center when we bombarded Tech World. And do you know what? If those shells came arcing down into this general vicinity, we're all paced."
You may be correct, but that's not our decision to make.
Oh, sure, I said. The fleet people might get around to reviving all of us eventually, but what do you think will happen to your auxiliary cohort if all the dragons are destroyed? Do you think the Hog Brass will give you a budget to buy 100 new ones? Might it not be easier and much cheaper to disband your command and call it a bad idea?
Winslade grimly watched me as I mouthed these damning words. He'd never been a man with a pleasant expression, but if looks could kill, I'd have been struck dead.
"Don't you think I know that, McGill?" he hissed. "Is this private discussion just an excuse for you to gloat before we're all blown to atoms?"
"No, sir, I'm trying to solve our mutual problem."
"Which is?"
"Turov, of course. Are you aware I have a special relationship with her? I might be able to put in a good word." He chewed his lower lip for a second. It was an ugly thing to watch a man do.
"Why not?" he said. "It will stir up the machines, but they're tearing up the landscape anyway. Let's call her."
He used his private comm unit to contact Turov, then handed me the headset. She didn't answer right off, but I let the channel request continue beeping in her ear. If any other non-com had pulled this stunt, they'd have been up for a court-martial by the end of the day. But Turov and I had a connection that I was willing to gamble on.
"What is it, Winslade?" she answered finally. "I have command preparations to make. You can't simply contact me whenever you wish. It's unseemly."
Yes, Imperator. This is Veteran James McGill, sir. I apologize, sir, but this is quite literally a matter of life and death."
"McGill?" she asked incredulously. "What are you talking about?"
"Have you ever seen the impact point of a barrage from one of these warships, Imperator? Well, I have. 3 times, in fact, if you include the bombardment of the Squid Moon base in this system. In fact, I've aimed and fired them myself more than once. I think I'm the only human in existence who can make that claim." She was silent for a second. I figured she was probably seething.
"That's not officially acceptable information, Veteran," she said.
It sounded like her words were coming out between clenched teeth. The officially acceptable information she was referring to was a lie she and I had cooked up back on Tech World. It was generally known that I'd been involved in the firing of Minotaur's broadsides, but Turov's official story to the brass had left my significant role out. She liked to pretend it was all her idea to fire the big guns. Actually, our arrangement had been more of a mutually beneficial bargain than a plan. A plan, to my way of thinking, required forethought and, well, planning. We'd made our deal in the heat of desperation. For all its flaws, the arrangement had kept me from being permed for misconduct, while it gave her the galactic key. Almost as important, it misled everyone who cared into believing I'd fired Minotaur's big guns under her orders. It was a fiction that had benefited us both for over a year now. If it ever got out that a minor subordinate under her command had changed the course of a battle, and possibly all of human history, her career would have been toast. She and I had always pretended my firing of the broadsides at the squid ship was part of her grand scheme, part of her innovative boldness.
"How did you get Winslade's comset anyway?" she demanded.
"I borrowed it, sir. Anyway, back to the broadsides. I'm telling the truth, and we both know it. We've seen what these weapons can do. You have to know that the 2 surviving cohorts down here will die in the blast, along with the enemy machines."
"You're correct," she said after a quiet pause. "We'll wait until after midnight when all the machines show up. We'll even send back and forth some radio signals to get them stirred up. I admit that some damage may be sustained due to friendly fire. The machines are so well stacked up, however, we can't afford to miss this opportunity to wipe them all out."
"But you can't use those weapons here, sir. They'll destroy everything. I don't think Winslade's cohort would even survive."
You're wrong. Our techs have done the math. You're sheltering at a considerable depth.
Sir, we're underground. This land is highly metallic and will carry a seismic disturbance a long way. A cave-in is guaranteed. We'll be crushed. She was silent again for a long second. I had the feeling she was consulting with someone else.
"Why are you bringing this to me now?" she demanded. "Is Winslade behind your complaints? Is he hiding in that hole with you?"
I glanced at Winslade. He slowly shook his head. "This is all me, sir," I told Turov. "Hold your fire. We think we can break out of this mess."
"How?"
"Commit the lifters, sir. We only need three of them. Just think, if the dragons are all wiped out, damn, that's a lot of expensive hardware destroyed. You'll have to explain the loss to hegemony. After losing Pegasus, the bill for this campaign must be pretty high already."
"You want me to risk three lifters to save your sorry ass a death? Is that it?"
"It would be the considerate thing to do, sir."
"Do I hear a threat?"
she asked suddenly.
"You're implying you'll talk about our prior dealings if I don't comply, correct?"
This turn in the conversation startled me. I hadn't been implying anything of the kind. I'd been more hoping to persuade her to see reason than trying to apply pressure. "No, sir, I..."
"That won't work, McGill. All I have to do is withhold your revival indefinitely. After a week, your data could be quietly lost. Regrettable, but it's happened before." "Told you it wouldn't work," Winslade said quietly.
I glanced at him. He'd either been listening in on my conversation, or he was pretty good at reading my disappointed facial expressions. I was finally getting mad at Turov. This woman suspected everyone of skullduggery just because she was so good at it herself. "Listen, Imperator," I said, "I'm not threatening you with anything. Our secrets are safe. What I'm suggesting is a way out of this. Don't risk the bombardment. Those broadsides will tear a hole in this planet's crust. You might lose everything. What if the squids show up again after that?" She was quiet again.
"I get it," she said. "I understand your confidence now. You would not dare to threaten me if you didn't have an ace in the hole, as they say. I haven't forgotten your maneuvering during the elections last year. You must have friends in Varus and aboard my ships. People who will blackmail me to get you revived. I hadn't thought you would."
"Never mind." I hardly knew what she was talking about. People often attribute near-godlike powers to me, but honestly, I only half knew what the heck I was doing most of the time. But what I did glean from her little monologue was that she was nervous. People who have something to protect can be manipulated by threatening the precious thing they hold so dear. In Turov's case, her downfall was her career. It had been put together on shaky ground, and I knew there were plenty of people who wanted to see her fall. If you were to ask me, I'd say she'd become a bit paranoid about it. The opportunist in me moved quickly to capitalize on her state of mind. "Well, sir, there's an easy way out of all your worries. Just send us the three lifters."
"You want me to risk more invaluable assets?" she demanded. "Fine, but you'll get only one lifter, not three. And I'll only wait 4 hours for you to complete the evacuation. Tell Winslade that. I can hear him shivering nearby. After 4 hours, I'm going to fire the big guns and obliterate the region."
"Thank you, sir," I said, but she'd already closed the channel. I gave Winslade a big grin. She went for it.
"I heard. One lifter? That's never going to be enough. We've got a full cohort of exhausted troops and a cohort of heavy cavalry."
Blinking, I nodded. The sneaky bastard had been listening in. I had no idea how he'd done it. "Well, sir," I said, "I'll give my jump seat to a Solstice man if you'll give up yours. Sure, it'll be a squeeze, but if we shove a few units into the top section and stack them up in the officers' quarters, we'll make out." Winslade looked put out, but resigned.
"More likely, we'll lose half our men breaking out. That will solve all our weight problems."
I nodded. I'd been thinking that, too, but didn't want to say it out loud. As we prepared for our exodus, I wondered about the bargain I'd made with Turov. From her point of view, I'd blackmailed her. That would probably cost me later on. Part of my private motivation was to save machine lives as well as human lives. I didn't think they deserved mass extinction, and I still held out hope we could make friends with them at some point. I hoped these frigging machines would appreciate the effort eventually, but I didn't think they ever would.
Chapter 21. It all went down fast and furious once the lifter gave us the go-code. The lifter pilot hadn't landed yet, mind you. He was letting his clumsy craft drift down toward the LZ, checking out every inch of ground for machines. Watching the operation unfold on the command screens, I could tell the crew wasn't keen on landing in the middle of a pile of giant, hungry machines, any one of which was a quarter the size of the lifter itself. That would have been akin to ringing the dinner bell again, and I couldn't blame them for being worried. All that refined metal in one digestible package, they'd be eaten alive, literally. Winslade began quietly filtering troops out onto the valley floor. For about 5 minutes, we got away with it. By that time, two full units were out there, one of cavalry and one Solstice unit of infantry. I wasn't sure exactly what the infantry was supposed to do, but I hoped their weaponeers could put some hurt downrange with their belchers if the machines charged us. For once, I wasn't in the front line formation. My squad, along with the rest of Graves's unit, was queued up to come out next. We were supposed to sneak out there quietly and hide in a fold of land out of sight from the machines. But we never got to that point. The sneaking ended when somebody transmitted something. We'd all been told to silence our transmissions, of course. We were to run silent, keeping every signal muted. We weren't even supposed to use our suit-to-suit intercoms. But somebody out of the hundreds had screwed up. It was bound to happen in a large, nervous formation of troops. Hell, some of us couldn't remember to silence our tappers when we went to the movies. The machines froze. All across the valley, they'd been scooting randomly over the walls between us and the Badlands. They all stopped moving for about a second, then reversed themselves. My squad was next in line to come out of our particular hole at that point, and I was provided a front-row seat on the action. "That's it," Graves shouted. "Cavalry forward. We'll take up the left flank, right where that big one is bearing down on the infantry. I want each squad to pick a target and take it down. Move." We thundered out of the tunnels. Finding themselves underfoot, the Solstice infantry scattered, throwing themselves out of the way of our grinding rush. One downstroke from my dragon's legs would squash an unarmored trooper as flat as a flapjack. We couldn't afford to pussyfoot around and make the infantry feel good about themselves this time. They were secondary, and everyone knew it. My squad followed right behind me. We thundered up a small fold in the land, lining up on top of it. The formation was a strange one, as we were operating under the assumption the enemy had no ballistic weaponry of their own. Instead of taking cover and choosing firing positions we knew were safe, we opted for maximum viewing range. I felt exposed, and I hoped it wouldn't matter. All Graves cared about was providing every dragon with a clear line of sight to the approaching enemy. It was uncanny to watch the machines decide as a single mass to charge our position. The machines didn't spin around. Instead, they sort of reshaped themselves into metal mounds that leaned in our direction, rather than away from us. Like teardrops of mercury, they shunted and shivered their way down the walls of the canyon with new purpose. They came from every direction, and they looked determined. Graves's sudden move placed us in the middle of the action with startling speed. The other cavalry unit that had already been deployed took their time adjusting themselves. They took aim and let loose. They fired first, but they only beat us by about 10 seconds. "Squad, I'm marking our target," I said. "Use your computer-aided targeting. Follow my lead and don't miss." When the target reticle changed from red to green, I squeezed the triggers in my gauntlets. The air cracked, and I could feel the vibration of the big cannon's recoil throughout my machine. Dragons unloaded their spinal cannons on every side of me moments later, and minor secondary shock waves set my machine swaying. Being on two legs, dragons weren't as stable as wheeled or tracked vehicles, but the gyro